Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
All right, let's get into it.
Hi, welcome back to our conversation with Sarah O'Keefe. We're continuing to discuss her chapter in the Content Operations book. Let's get back into it. It's interesting. So the one thing that isn't on your list here that I'm curious about is you didn't say anything about just raw capability. So you think about organizations that are coming from, even if they have digital systems, they have a number of digital systems which are inconsistent and not interoperable, and they're trying to deliver that into maybe a single experience, maybe into a product, maybe into a new application, you know, whatever it might be. And they very physically can't. So they lack a capability. Do you feel like that falls under one of the ways that you think about this? Or is that actually a fifth justification?
I think that ultimately it falls under scalability and velocity, because if you throw enough bodies at the problem, you can do it, right?
All right.
You copy and paste, you take a screenshot and you move it over there. I mean, you can do some horrific things.
That's
but
true.
If it's digital content, you can do it. But you can do it badly or you can do it well.
Yeah. my favorite terminology for this is sneaker net.
Uh-huh.
Which, I mean, to me, has never really been a part of my actual career, but what a sneaker net is for those of us who are too young for floppies is that it was pre-internet. Sneaker net was when you handed someone a floppy disk and they walked it across, you know, the campus someplace else to transfer data. And I just think that that's a funny visual whenever you think about manual labor to move information from one place to another.
And these days we sort of take high speed internet for granted, but there are a couple of places where you still see sneaker net. One is if you have a system that's air gapped. So
yes.
If it is cut off from the internet for security reasons and you need to get new content into that cutoff system, that is going to involve you hauling, okay, probably a USB drive and not a floppy, but you know, same difference.
Right.
There was a great study a while back where they looked at internet speeds in various places. This was, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. And they found a particular pipe. There was a bottleneck. And I think this was South Africa, but I'm not sure. And what they figured out was that sneaker net was not going to be the most efficient thing. But in fact, they looked at pigeon net,
yeah,
where you take a USB drive.
Wondering if you were going this direction.
Yep.
And of all networks.
You put it on the pigeon, like on a little, a foot thing.
Yeah.
And it's a homing pigeon, right? So it flies back to wherever it's going and delivers the USB drive, which you then plug in. And they found that that was, in fact, faster than trying to deliver these big files over the constrained internet at the time. So sneaker net is not quite dead, but it's getting there. And there are a few use cases. We used to talk about airplane help, but of course now for better or worse, we have Wi-Fi on airplanes.
Right. And I am so happy about that, because the number of times that we had customers say, well, what if I want to work in an airplane? And then they say, well, when was the last time you actually worked in an airplane? I said, well, but what if I want to? It's like, okay.
I have very mixed feelings about Wi-Fi on airplanes. I'm still not over it. You know, the fact that you're sitting up there and there's Wi-Fi, I will never get over that. But on the other hand, I'm sitting in my seat and I am connected to people and I can't just go watch a movie.
Yeah, I just pretend that I don't have it. So I can read a book or watch a movie.
Good strategy. I like it.
So anyways, actually getting back to your chapter and the content in this, you know, I think the business case is really an interesting aspect of this for me, because it's something that has always felt not squishy, but so individual that it's hard to generalize. even inside of like this framework, because and I think you kind of point this out in your chapter where you talk about, well, if you're a scrappy startup versus a Fortune 500, and then you listen to the language that you used around, well, if you have this or if you have this, then you need this. And like, there's a lot of like if-thens in the business case for this. So in a world where this gets so complicated so quickly, you know, how do you think that somebody who's really just stepping into this, who's just picking up this content operations book, should step back and think about like, okay, when should I start thinking about a business case for content operations? Like, what should be the moment where I'm like, okay, now I need to go understand the business value of this, and I need to start thinking about the business case, not the implementation.
Part of the squishiness is that some of the time when we talk about content operations, what we really mean is, you know, efficient, scalable, timely, consistent, compliant operations. But ultimately, content operations itself is just how are you doing the work? So I write a bunch of stuff in Word files and I hand carry them over to this other place and put them on this other server and reformat them and copy and paste. And then we send them for translation via like FTP. That's content ops. It's maybe not efficient, but it is, you know, your operational environment for your content. So all content has an operational environment, has a life cycle. It may or may not be a good one. You may not have any governance or control over what you're doing, but you have an as-is state of how this content gets created. And you can look at content maturity, like are you at level one chaos or have you, you know, completely optimized everything? But ultimately, you have something in place. The question that you ask when we say, let's make a business case for content ops, what we're really saying is, do you have a business case to change and improve what you're doing now? And the answer to that boils down to what are the things that you're trying to do? Can you do them well enough in your current environment? If not, what do you need to change? And is that change and the cost of that change with all that it entails in terms of new systems and, you know, retooling and retraining and all the rest of it, is that change worth the cost? So, or worth the investment, if you want to look at it that way. And that's really the question. It's how, you know, what is your business environment broadly? Mm-hmm. And what is the content operations approach that matches that business? And what's really interesting about this is, you know, we talk about startups. Well, if you have one writer or three writers and they're just kind of doing their thing and they're inefficient, it doesn't really matter because they're small and they can do what needs to be done. But then the company with the three writers acquires another company with five writers and another company with five more and a couple more. And all of a sudden you have 20 writers in like six different content systems and they're trying to unify all the products into a single environment. And the content is sitting in, you know, five different content systems. And now you actually have critical mass at 20. I mean, maybe less than 20, but 20 people clearly is critical mass for some sort of a really solid content operations environment. And, you know, that's where, you know, the Heretto and the other products in that class where you start talking about, we need to manage this content, we need to componentize it, it needs to be topic-based so that we can reuse it and move it around and do things with it and connect it to all these other systems that, you know, where it needs to go, which simply is not going to happen in an unstructured, unmanaged, you know, desktop tool.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. Everybody has ad hoc content operations. Mm-hmm. Because everybody produces content. So the business case is really about, when do we need to move to a formalized, more mature content operations process? You know, what are the triggers for that? And I think the acquisition, you know, or maybe just growth is one of the best answers to it. So
globalization is the other one.
Yeah, I mean, in localization, I guess broadly could be classified under growth, but maybe that's getting a little distinction without a difference there. So So then this kind of naturally leads me to the, you know, one of my last questions was, which is, if you're sitting inside of an organization, how far out into the future do you think you should be looking when you're trying to build a business case?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, because how far into the business, how far into the future is the business itself looking? Are they living quarter by quarter, or do they have like a 5-year plan or something in between? One of the things that we look at is when, and you know, most of the work that we do has to do with bringing people into a more mature operation, nearly always around structured content, right? That's that sort of transition or inflection point from unstructured to structured is where we live for the most part. When you reach that point and you start looking at your options, you do not want to be in a position where you're looking at what you're doing and what you're building and saying, well, this will hold us for 12 months, right? Because by the time you make whatever the transition is, and I don't care what it is, it, you know, 3 months at least go by, probably more like 6. And then you have a 6-month runway. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh. And it, to give you some examples of this from way back when, a long time ago, I was inside an organization doing some consulting, and they had like literally like FrameMaker 7. This is a long time ago. It did what it needed to do for them, unstructured, everything was great. They really wanted FrameMaker 8. Like the tech writers in this organization were like, well, we just want to move up to FrameMaker 8. And so we looked at it and it was fine, except that they had been told that there was a non-zero chance that they needed to deliver content in Arabic. And FrameMaker 8 would not do Arabic, a right-to-left language.
Yeah.
It just would not. And so we were faced with this idea that either we would put them, you know, move them up into FrameMaker 8 and update their templates and do a few other things, knowing that we needed a different workflow for Arabic because it would not do it. There were people, apparently there are people that did this with custom fonts and mirrors, but I just, no. Yeah. So do we put you in FrameMaker 8 knowing that it won't deliver on Arabic and we're going to have to do that some other way? Or do we say, you know what, you're going to have to switch systems because you have a language requirement that you cannot meet in this system? So how do you address that divergence? And really the point of this story is that if you are looking at making an investment as a leader, you know, you're the tech comm director or manager or VP or the person with responsibility for product content. If you're looking at making an investment in content ops and you're looking downstream and you know what the requirements are that are probably coming in 12 to 18 months to 2 years, you have to build a system that meets those requirements. You cannot say, I don't want to do it. I'm not ready. I mean, you can stay with what you have and kick the can down the road and postpone your investment maybe, but you cannot go and ask for money to put in a new system that will not address known future requirements. That is a path to a short career at that company.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can, and I think we've both seen organizations do that. You should.
Right. But you're not going to catch me telling them to do it.
Right.
I'm going to say, this is bad. It's one thing to say our current system can't do X. It is entirely another system thing to say, I need some money. And oh, by the way, we still can't do X.
Right. And so I think this kind of gets to the heart of like the, you know, how far into the future do you look? And this is one of the things that was a little bit of a struggle for me when I was writing my chapter in this book, because I recognize I have a bias. Right, there's no doubt about that in terms of like how I think about these systems and how I think about standing them up and running them over the long haul. But at the same time, I think that there's good evidence that when you look at these systems, they get things thrown at them down the line and not that far down the line that they don't expect, right? Like it's very uncommon that you install a content operation system and that system does the things that you expected it to do when you built it. And that's it, right? Like, it's like those days of like PDF and print are gone, where like, we know our outputs are going to look like this. They'll look like this in 3 to 5 years. But that's just not the world that we live in anymore, because the content goes into products. It goes into different devices. Web interactions change constantly. Like, the ways that we interact with these things change. So, like, when I think about this question, I just don't think that any formalized implementation that's not built on structured content is a wise approach. Because even though structured content comes with overhead, and it comes with, in a lot of cases, higher upfront investment, the thing that it has that has been proven time and time again is that it will work down the line, like almost without fail. Yes, sometimes you have to build things onto it or ahead of it in the publishing process, but it will always work. So for me, that's kind of the big thing about looking out into the future, other than like the really practical things that you know you're going to have to tackle in like the, not the near term, but kind of the medium term.
We like to talk about unknown future requirements. Mm-hmm. When the Kindle rolled out and it had this new format, which is EPUB adjacent, sort of, yeah. But not exactly. You suddenly, we have to find a way to deliver this content for Kindle. How do we do that? There is value, and this goes to your capability question. I'm not going to die on the hill of whether or not capability is a separate thing. But I would kind of bucket it into scalability and velocity again. So it's the same kind of thing. A new requirement comes along. We have more languages. They have complex glyphs. Can your system handle that? We've decided to, a lot of this is about downstream outputs or publishing pipelines or delivery endpoints. Can we connect to this system over here? And where system over here is an unknown future system, not yet specified, right? I have literally gone into organizations where they said, we're rolling out a new web CMS. Okay, great. What is it? We don't know yet. Okay. Yeah. Well, so your content has to go to the unknown future web CMS. Okay, great. So our best shot at that is to have a system that has maximum flexibility in terms of what kinds of things it can output and what kinds of options it offers to connect, reach in, grab the content, or push the content. You know, how can I connect this system to other systems?
Yeah.
That's one of the risks you run into, is that ultimately, when you look at some of the, and it's not really structured versus unstructured content per se, it's more framework systems and software that allow you to extend and connect versus what I would describe as a more closed system that is difficult to extend. Mm-hmm. If the closed system gives you what you need today, it has all the publication endpoints that you need, and it connects over to the thing that you need, and it does all the stuff that you need on the inside in terms of authoring and whatever else, then it meets your needs in the moment today. And it's probably going to be cheaper to build it out because it's all in there. Like, if your needs are inside the box that they give you, then hooray. The problem that you run into is, what if you have to get outside the box, right? What if you have a new requirement that takes you outside of what that system, what that vendor is giving you, and how are you going to do that? And at that point, you're faced with either we do it the hard way by hand, we do a bunch of configuration work, we do a bunch of custom integration work. I mean, you have some options, but they may not be great. And so I'm mostly agreeing with you, but I would say that this is less a question around is the content structured, and that's part of it. But additionally, the system that you're stashing this content in, or that you're managing this content with, how easy is it to extend that and connect it to other things, especially other things not yet identified?
That's a really, really important and valid point. So even if you're using a component content management system that is, based on or built on Ditta, but you can't get stuff in and out of it in an interoperable way. It's like there's no point in having an open standard locked in a closed system.
And well, again, if the closed system meets all your requirements, then great, onward.
Right, but like you never know what your future requirement's going to be. And that's the risk that you run.
So then you're back to the speed of change inside that organization. So the company that buys the system has to look at what is our corporate culture? How fast do we change? What do our life cycles look like? I'm going to say stodgier, which sounds a little judgy, right? But the slower and stodgier they are, which is probably related to their regulatory environment and their product types, the more likely it is that they have a, you know, 5 or 10 year runway for new requirements instead of a next week runway. The faster they are, I mean, again, you know, video games are such a great example of this because they have to localize usually, and they have to localize well, because if it sounds clunky, people are like, this isn't fun. I'm not playing this game. Your French is crud. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, another device comes along, right? Like a phone or a tablet or a screen or a bigger screen or, this week it's VR goggles. Great. And you have to deliver your game.
Technically.
Yeah. You have to deliver your game into that new system. And can you do it? And how? If I'm in video games, I'm extremely interested in making sure that I can go fast, break things, and get it from point A to point B to point C to point like Omega Outer Planet, because that's what's going to happen. If I'm producing, mining equipment that's air gapped, then I'm slightly less interested because my runway for actually creating new mining, I don't even know, trucks, machines, things, is years. Right? You don't just like flip a switch and roll a new one off the line, unlike video games and software generally.
That's fair. I think that definitely the velocity of the underlying business is a is a fundamental consideration. I don't think I'm going to dive too deeply into a philosophical argument as to whether or not that should change your an open system versus a closed system.
Yeah, I'm just saying if it matches you have to match to your business requirements. And you're arguing that there's always going to be an unknown requirement that's going to blow up your closed system. And I'm not really disagreeing.
I'm fully arguing that, yes.
Yeah, I'm sort of like, yep, seen that. And then sometimes the closed system wins for other reasons, having to do with risk and implementation and some other things.
Or just raw features. Like there's no doubt that, you know, there's certain closed systems that have really compelling features. So I think that's going to have to be where we leave it on this very lovely conversation. So thank you so much for being here, Sarah. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And thanks for, you know, being my co-author.
Yeah, well, thanks for working on this for years and years and years. And I would like to close again by thanking Carlos for all the work that he did, because without him, this thing would not have actually happened. So thank you, Carlos.
That is very, very true and a really good point to end on. Big thank you to Carlos. And thank you, everybody, for joining us and listening to Components. Hope you'll join us again in the future. We'll be posting all of the authors from each of the chapters, a conversation with each one of them, having a little bit to describe what it is that brought them into the book and how they're thinking about it. So stay tuned, and we'll have more coming your way soon. Thanks. Bye.